Okay, today we're going to start a section on the topic of mammalian cell genetics. That is the genetic manipulation of mammalian cells in culture. And it'll probably go into about half of next time. So I assigned one paper, which is now the category of supplementary material. So I won't cover that very modern aspect of cell genetics, a very interesting paper, I thought, a whole company based on that technology. And that's targeted mutation. So let's define genetics. So the way I look at genetics, it's you can look at it in two ways. One is the study of what genes do, and that includes how they're expressed and how they're inherited and how they're changed and mutated and recombined. All the things about genes, which is a very big topic, right? Or you can think of genetics as a tool, and that is using genetics in order to study anything in biology. So it could be consciousness. So within the rubric of genetics, I can see it divided into about four kinds of operations. First, and to me foremost, especially for this kind of biotechnology, is mutation. And that is the change of the genome to give you some advantage, either an insight into how things are working or to produce a cell that's going to make a useful protein. And there's kind of two ways to approach that. One is you just mutagenize cells or mutagenize your DNA and then select for the phenotype you're interested in from among millions or thousands, however you design the experiment. Or you can take a targeted approach, as was taken in this paper I assigned. Second kind of thing you do is find out where things are in the genome. That's mapping. And traditionally, it's done by mating and looking for the linkage, that is an operational definition of two genes or two markers or two nucleotide changes segregating together in a sexual cross. The more modern version is you sequence the genome to find your mutation. But that's not so easy, right? Because there's a lot of noise in genomes. If you're looking for one specific change, that's still very hard to do. Although it's being done with model organisms like C. elegans and yeast. The other kind of manipulation you can do is to see how two genes work in the presence of, two alleles of a gene work in the presence of each other. And that gives you insight into the biochemistry. It gives you your first insights into what the biochemical mechanism behind those gene products, especially whether one allele is dominant over the other, so or one is recessive, where it might be a loss of function or a gain of function. And that can give you insight into what the genes do. So these kinds of operations are done either in the whole organism or they're done in cell culture. And in cell culture, there's some advantages and some disadvantages. But there's ways to approach these three and now a fourth manipulation. Fourth manipulation is sort of related a bit to the mapping or the gene juxtaposition, but instead of doing matings, you just put your gene in and look at it in the face of other genes, or if you get fancy, you can replace the gene that's normally there with the gene of your choice and the allele mutation of your choice. So in cell culture, that was established once it became possible to transfect DNA into a cell and get it integrated and expressed. So we'll talk about all these things. So The greatest advantage of doing genetics in cell culture is that you can screen lots of genetic individuals. Each cell in a cell culture dish can be considered as an independent genetic entity, the mammalian cell as a microorganism, if you will. So if you want to do the whole organism and you want to study mammals, then you're forced to look at the mouse, which is the smallest mammal, and although there are big institutes where buildings filled with mice are at your disposal, it's expensive, and you're still limited to tens of thousands of mice, probably. I don't know, maybe 100,000 mice. That would be a big experiment, right? Costly. Whereas in one culture dish of 10 centimeters, you can have 10 million genetic individuals. Second advantage of culture is that since you're growing a clone cell line, as a first approximation, all the cells are the same. Yes, they're in different parts of the cell cycle. You can get finer and talk about heterogeneity within the culture, and it certainly exists. But compared to a whole organism, they're much simpler. So if you take a whole dish of cells and you grind it up and extract your protein or DNA or RNA, you can be pretty sure that as a first approximation, what's true for your biochemical measurement on a million cells was true for most of the individual cells. Whereas you can't do that with a fly or a mouse because they're made up of heterogeneous tissues. So you don't know whether your marker is coming from the wings or the antenna or some other tissue. So those are the advantages. But there's plenty of disadvantages, and that you can't look at complicated phenotypes like a shaking mouse with a neurological defect. You don't see that in the cells in culture. So you have a limited number of phenotypes. And especially the differentiated phenotypes, or the phenotypes that make one tissue different from another, which is in the study of the whole study of development based on that, how cells differ from one another, how you go from one fertilized egg to a whole complete organism with all kinds of different cells. So you can get cells that do liver type things from, or cells that that do blood type things. But they're not usually, if they're a cell line, an immortal cell line, they're a little messed up, as we discussed earlier. Their chromosomes number is not right. But they can express, you can get cells that express liver-specific proteins like albumin and liver enzymes in culture, and muscle cells. You can get muscle cells to grow and to differentiate in culture, to actually start to beat in culture. So there is some parts you can study, but it is compromised. A third disadvantage is looking at segregation of alleles is difficult in mammalian cells. It's possible, but it's difficult. So when you make a transgenic mouse and you knock out one allele and you have this heterozygote, and you want to see what's the effect of knocking out both alleles, and see what's this gene doing. So you try to look at the situation where it's not being expressed. You need to knock out two alleles. Well, in the mouse, it takes some time, but not that much time. So you mate litter mates of mice, both heterozygous, and a quarter of the progeny will be the homozygous negative. And either it will die in an early embryonic stage, which is already information, or it will live and express some phenotype, as many mice are bred to act as models, for instance, for human genetic disease. So in culture cells, that's harder to do, the double knockout, but it's possible. I already talked about, this is just grayed out, sort of, and to remind you, because I've rearranged my lectures this year, I've already talked about the establishment of cell lines and what's the difference between cell lines and primary cultures and things like that, and the karyotypes. So let's start with a mutation and how you can cause mutation in mammalian cells. In the early days of mammalian cell genetics, there was much skepticism and pessimism about whether you could do the kind of genetics you can do in E. coli. because you can get heritable changes in cells that aren't due to strictly mutation. So let's define mutation then. Mutation being the change in the Watson-Crick base, in a Watson-Crick base pair from wild type to a mutant situation, a difference. Right? You have to be careful about how you define it, because there's changes that happen to the DNA that's actually very currently a pretty hot topic, these epigenetic changes. But even then, in the 70s, it was known that cells exhibit different phenotypes in culture, just like these liver-type cells from hepatomas versus fibroblast cell. They inherit a program to make either collagen or to make albumin, and these are heritable differences, and these are variants of each other. They all have the same genotype, but they have a different phenotype. So any kind of variation you look for in culture is bound to be clouded by that. But it turned out that you can still do, in the face of that, that's not so easy to change, or we're only learning now how to change that. And so that it's possible to induce mutations in cultured cells and show that they really are mutations and get even the sequence changed. So, is it better if I'm out here? So, for instance, the most dramatic, in a way, epigenetic change that comes closest to a mutation is the actual covalent modification of the DNA, which is principally in mammals and many higher organisms through the methylation of C at a CpG dinucleotide. And that takes place after replication, soon after replication. And it's associated with different kinds of chromatin organization. I hesitate to say it causes it, but it's certainly associated with it. And then there's, so beyond that covalent modification, then there's a lot of non-covalent modifications, such as the organization of the chromatin at the locus, at the gene, within the gene, at places maybe within the gene that you're interested in, and that influence the expression of the gene and are somehow inherited as that cell divides into two cells, so that those modified histones are once again modified the same way. And this is a subject of much study right now. It's gotten this renaissance. All these questions were true for 30 years, but it's gotten a renaissance since the number one, the sequencing of mammalian genomes. Complete sequencing, that's like 10 years ago. And then more recently, in the last 3 or 4 years, the high throughput sequencing, resequencing that we talked about earlier, making it possible to look not only at the sequence, but also the chromatin organization, the methylation, all these things can be done now at a genome level. So there's tremendous amount of information that's accumulated. And right now we're at a stage where we're trying to start to integrate that information and try to figure out how it works. Right? But it gets in the way of the true mutation as I defined it earlier. Right? The problem of making mutations in established cell lines is that, first of all, even if you had the most beautiful established cell line with respect to its chromosome content, and as euploid as possible, it's still diploid for everything except those on the X chromosome, all genes. So that and most mutations knock out function, so it's hard you'd essentially need to do knock out two copies in order to see the phenotype that you're chasing. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Then why not produce haploid cells? It was a big effort for a while to produce haploid cells. There's actually haploid frogs that grow, and they're smaller. But no good cell lines established from those frogs. Recently, there's been the purported isolation of a human near haploid. I think it has one small extra chromosome beyond the haploid set. But so far, I haven't seen too much come of that. You would think that there might be a problem with haploid cells, especially human, because they're not inbred. So there would be a lot of mass recessive mutations that, okay, they're not going to cause some phenotype at the organismic level. But even for cell growth, you'd think something that might be affected. But there is this one cell line. But for the most part, not only are they not haploid, they're not even diploid, they're heteroploid, with three or four copies of every chromosome. So you're not talking about knocking out two, you're talking about knocking out three or four. So I again contrast that to people who work on model organisms, the whole organisms, where this is not a problem because you have segregation and reassortment and isolation of homozygotes by looking in the F2 generation. So let's consider some of the solutions to this diploidy problem, making it the least problem. So the heavy-handed, easiest in a way, at least conceptually easiest, is just do heavy mutagenesis. So when you mutagenize cells, of course, you're knocking out lots of things. If you use some, if you look at spontaneous mutation, for example, spontaneous mutation is about the frequencies are of the order of less than 1 in 1,000,000 per gene, let's say. A knockout of a gene occurs maybe 10 to the minus 7th. So the chance of knocking out two genes would be 10 to the minus 14th, and that would be beyond our ability to screen. However, you can treat the cells with mutagens, which will are generally DNA damaging agents. They can be either chemical or physical. And you can get as high as 1 in 1,000 cells showing a mutation in the gene you're interested in. So these early numbers are mostly for genes that are only present in one copy, of which there are thousands because they're on the X chromosome. So even if you have a cell from derived from a female with two X chromosomes, it's still almost all of those genes on the two X chromosomes, only one chromosome is active and the other is inactive. So that's a dosage compensation effect in mammals that takes place early in development. So you have all those genes to work with. If you look at those genes and immunogenize heavily and look at X-linked genes, you can get several times 10 to the minus 4th, and some reports even higher than that, up to 10 to the minus 3rd, which means for those genes like that, except they're autosomal, then you're down to 10 to the minus 3 squared, roughly, so that's about 10 to the minus 6th, and that's in the range where you can really select for that. Of course, if you mutagenize that heavily, first of all, a lot of the cells die, and you have to design your experiments so that you start with enough cells. Generally, you kill about 90% of the cells, and you have 10% of the cells remaining. And you look among them, and that's where you get your 1 in 1,000, or 1 in 1,000,000 if it's a double knockout. So that's possible, but since there's 20,000 genes and even more gene products, if 1 in 1,000 has knocked out a particular gene, it means your cell is really riddled with other non-lethal, by definition, because you're looking at survivors, but other mutations as a background. But generally, we don't worry about that. Some of these same considerations, it's interesting, apply to this big somatic cell genetic problem, which is cancer, which is also, from the point of view of the cancer, is a problem getting dysregulation by knocking out tumor suppressor genes. So cancers usually go through stages where one allele is knocked out and then another allele is knocked out. Some of the cancer-causing mutations are dominant, so only one change is needed. But others are recessive, and there's ways that these cells can undergo the double knockout or the homozygous state, which we'll talk about in a minute. Instead of looking for mutants of your gene, if you have an idea of what your gene is, you can use RNAi to knock down, so that will inhibit or knock down, if not out, the expression of your particular gene. And if you have a phenotype you can select for, you don't even have to know what your gene is, so you can add a library of RNAi molecules and in theory isolate those that express a certain phenotype. If you have a good selective technique, you can find those one in a million or 1 in 10 million, and then go in after treatment with this library and find out which siRNA molecules have been are being produced in that cell. Normally you do it with a DNA vector that produces the siRNA. And we'll talk about siRNA a bit a little later. So you can recover those sequences, you can repeat the experiment with because maybe you'll have many such sequences, and then narrow it down to the one that works. Yes?
Is RNAi specific enough to knock down one allele but not another mutated allele?
No. Generally, you wouldn't be able to do that because the RNA targets are probably not going to coincide with the difference in nucleotide sequence corresponding to your alleles. They're going to be probably in the protein coding part. Most of the RNA is targeted towards the 3' untranslated region and a very small region at that of 20 base pairs or so. So generally, you won't be able to do that. So all you can do is knock down the whole business. But that's, yes, for certain kinds of experiments, you might want to do that, then the RNAi is not useful. But you can imagine constructing experiments, for example, where you know your gene and you have one allele and the other allele, and if you had you could put on your own 3' untranslated region, target that region, it would be an artificial region, but you could sort of turn things off that way. Or you could do that, you could use your TET-responsive promoter and just produce it or not. So there's lots of ways to get around going that direction. Here's a way, without causing double mutation, you can get you can start with a heterozygous situation where you've only knocked out one gene, or a pro-tumor cell has undergone a single mutation in a tumor suppressor, but the other allele is still active. And it's a way to get a homozygous situation, even just during, without sex, without assortment, but just using mitosis. So if we look at this pair of chromosomes, say, of autosomes, a blue paternal and a red maternal. And on the left, these aren't crossing one another. On the left, you have this post-replication. So this is what it looks like in mitosis, right? So you have two chromatids that are genetically identical because they just came from the replication of that single double-stranded DNA molecule as G1 went through S phase. And and one allele here is negative and the other is positive, so you can't detect any phenotype. But if there's now a crossover between these two homologs, now the homologs line up during meiosis, and they synapse, and they get this nice assortment, but these are not gametes, these are just cells growing vegetatively. And although the position of DNA within the nucleus may not be random. There's evidence that there may be positioning, at least of the DNA, in certain parts of the nucleus, territories. There's no good reason to think, maybe we don't know yet, but there's no good reason to think that that in mitotically growing cells, the two homologs synapse together to allow this. On the other hand, they're both there. So by chance, sometimes they will be close to one another. They have homologous sequences, after all. And so this mitotic recombination can take place at a very low frequency. What you see at a high frequency, if you label differentially the two chromatids, which you can do with certain tricks, then you see that these lines, these are the centromeres, so that the two chromatids undergo recombination spontaneously at a very high rate. A typical chromosome has undergone one or two such recombinations in every cell cycle. But these are being held together and are closely opposed. So, but the enzymology is there for doing this homologous recombination. But sister chromatid exchange, the two sisters, doesn't involve any genetic change. Whereas this mitotic recombination between homologs, right, hope you remember all these terms from your early studies of genetics, you see gives a multicolored thing here. So the plus allele is now connected to a centromere that's also harboring a negative allele. So when it comes time to undergo mitosis, these are going to randomly assort, and this so that this minus guy over here, red and blue, and this blue and red plus guy could both go to one daughter chromosome, and then this plus and this minus will go to the other daughter chromosome, and you're left with a heterozygote just as you started. So this is the boring outcome. There's a 50-50 chance you get this. But there's a 50-50 chance also that the two plus chromatids will end up in the same daughter cell, and importantly, the two minus chromosomes will also end up in that daughter cell, and this daughter cell now can express that previously masked knockout phenotype. So this has been reported to take place during the development of cancer, and as a way that that the tumor cell can develop and express its unregulated phenotype. Some of the agents you use for mutagenesis produce different kinds of results. Some of the most powerful are chemicals that adduct onto the DNA bases and cause a change in coding potential as the DNA polymerase goes through. Either you see no coding potential, and so you just don't know what to put in, or the DNA is distorted. So popular ones like ethylmethane sulfonate, very powerful. Most of these mutagens are also carcinogens, not surprisingly. Nitrosoguanidine and ethylmethane sulfonate cause mostly point mutations, usually targeting the guanine residues. Bleomycin, structure of which I don't know, can cause small deletions. UV is a very easy kind of mutagen to employ instead of having to work with these terrible chemicals. Cause mostly point mutations. They form, UV causes two sequential pyrimidines to cross-link to each other on the same strand of the DNA. And then when it comes time to replicate, those bases aren't available for directing the Watson-Crick base pairing, and so you get mistakes there. Or they're recognized as, and this is true for all the adducts, they're recognized by the surveillance machinery of the cell as being something wrong with the DNA, and there are enzymes then that will target those bad bases, those pyrimidine dimers, or adducted ethylated guanines, and chew away the DNA that's there, along with dozens or scores of nucleotides around it, and then fill that in again. But the filling in process is error prone, so you tend to get mutations even if you repair at a higher rate. Ionizing, so UV is done at 260 nanometers, which is where the bases of the DNA absorb maximally. Ionizing radiation, on the other hand, is powerful radiation, like from cosmic rays going through us as we speak, as I speak, and or if you go to the dentist, or and get X-rays, or if you're exposed to some nuclear power plant. And these cause mainly clouds of free radicals as they go through the cell, like OH free radicals. They're very reactive, they're very ephemeral, and as they go by near the DNA, all these free radicals can, this cloud of free radicals can cause major change, which results usually in breaks in the DNA that are so efficiently produced that you get a double strand break. So you just like break two single strands close to one another and you get a double strand break. The cell has repairs for those double strand breaks. If you'll read this paper on targeted mutation, it takes advantage of that double strand break repair, which is also very error prone. So ionizing radiation usually produces big deletions of millions of base pairs, inversions, or rearrangements between two different chromosomes. Sometimes you can get a lot of information by looking at dominant mutations. So some of the early oncogenes were discovered this way. We'll talk about it in a few minutes. I can think of, for instance, drug resistance. Alpha mannitin, which is the poison in poisonous mushrooms, inhibits RNA polymerase 2, and so you die if you eat it. But if you treat cells, they also die. But if you mutagenize the cells and then take the survivors and expose them to alpha mannitin, maybe not a huge amount, enough to kill virtually all the cells, but you have some survivors. Among those survivors, you can find altered protein sequence for RNA polymerase 2 such that it becomes a smarter enzyme and isn't inhibited by the alpha mannitin. It can still work. So this has become very useful, like 20 years later, people studying how the RNA polymerase works. And so you can control which RNA polymerase you have by simply inhibiting the endogenous RNA polymerase with alpha mannitin and adding this separately, this alpha mannitin resistant form that you have genetically altered to your liking, and seeing what effect it has. So mutants, often very useful. So what kinds of mutants can you get? And it can fall into some categories. We talked about in yeast, and certainly in E. coli, auxotrophic mutants that have been used very to good advantage in manipulating, for instance, the yeast to hybrid system, these His minus and leucine minus pathways. And there's a few auxotrophs that have been isolated in mammalian cells. Mammalian cells can't make a lot of the stuff that yeast or E. coli can, so you have to provide it in the medium, but there are things that you can make. So there's been amino acid auxotrophs that require glycine or proline or glutamine, or purines or pyrimidines. All of these pathways are active in most mammalian cells. So this selection, how do you select something that can't do something? So that's kind of a clever selection. I think it's on the next slide here. Yeah, number 8. So an auxotroph selection works by killing the growing cells and allowing the deficient cells to survive and not to die. And so the trick is you take your mutagenized population. Somewhere in there is a deficient cell, say, that can't make glycine, and then you put it in a medium in which glycine is not present. So most medium has all 20 amino acids, so you have to get special medium. So under these conditions, this cell will stop growing because it doesn't have any glycine, whereas the others are quite happy to make their own glycine, not bothered by this. You give it a period of starvation, let's say a day, and hope that this starvation isn't actually killing this glycine-requiring cell that's in your population. Then in this minimal medium lacking glycine, you add BRDU, which is the modern name for BUDR. This is an old paper. And BUDR gets incorporated instead of thymidine into the DNA. So the cells that are growing incorporate this BUDR, which actually doesn't bother them. They're quite content to have BUDR instead of thymidine. It still codes and directs the incorporation of A opposite it, just like T. It's about the same, bromine about the same size as a methyl group. So it doesn't distort the DNA. But what it does do is it changes the wavelength at which the DNA will absorb light. So normally thymine would absorb around 260, like most of the nucleotides, but bromouracil, which is the analog of thymine with bromine instead of the methyl group, absorbs at a much higher wavelength, which is like blue light or black light, up around 313, which is normally is not harmful to you. So if you, after a day of incorporation of BUDR, those growing cells will have incorporated the BRDU. And so you shine light on them for a while, and you kill off all those that have incorporated the BRDU, and you're left with this guy who is not growing. And he's on his way out, but before it's too late and he's starving to death, you give him enriched medium that contains glycine, and now you look for surviving colonies. So it's not perfect, but among those surviving colonies, if you pick 10, you'll find one. And if you specifically leave out glycine, that's what you'll get. This kind of method, for instance, was used by Nobel Prize winners Goldstein and Brown to to knock out the first enzyme cholesterol biosynthesis. They used this technique, and it required mevalonic acid, which is like the first or second intermediate in the pathway to making cholesterol. They could identify the key enzyme in cholesterol biosynthesis, which is the target for all these statins. Right? So this kind of thing has practical importance. Let's take another category. It's a lot easier and more direct, which is drug resistance. So I already mentioned alpha-manitin. Other drugs that inhibit enzymes are good targets for this because they, if they inhibit the enzyme, there's always a chance that you can select mutants of that enzyme that have a decreased affinity for the inhibitor and yet are still catalytically active. So wobane inhibits a sodium pump in the membrane, and wobane resistant mutants would be resistant and have an altered amino acid. I should emphasize that these dominant mutations, there's very direct selection, very powerful. However, the chance that you're going to hit make an amino acid change which will make this enzyme smarter is very low. There might be only one or two places and one or two kinds of changes that would do it. Whereas to knock out the function, it's like 100 times easier. But you have this problem of expression. Even the knocking out is not... The enzymes are pretty resistant. The number I have in my head is about only about a third of the mutational changes in a gene that change an amino acid. I'm not talking about changes that don't actually make synonymous codons. But change in amino acid, only about a third of them are deleterious. So this kind of drug resistance has been used especially in this very complicated looking slide. I mean, it's not just complicated looking, it is complicated. So I put this in for your reference, and because it's a couple of pathways that have been very much utilized. It's very important in the establishment of the technology for producing monoclonal antibodies, for example. Used mutant cells that were altered in these pathways. So let's just look at it for a minute, kind of give you some guidelines for how to look at it, and then you can gaze at it at your leisure. So here's this in the middle, this pathway for purine synthesis. You start with phosphoribosyl pyrophosphate, which is just ribose with a bunch of phosphates. And that's your starting. And then you start building the ring that's going to be attached to this ribose, which is going to be the purine ring. You start with glutamine and put that nitrogen from the glutamine side chain on. And there's about 10 steps or so. Some of those steps require tetrahydrofolate, so this DHFR comes in again, which is producing this tetrahydrofolate, which is necessary for two of these steps. The tetrahydrofolate also is necessary for the production of glycine and particularly thymidine in the pyrimidine pathway. Then you reach a point where you have inosine monophosphate. So inosine, the base, is called hypoxanthine. And it's not one of the bases that's in RNA or DNA. And you have to go a couple more steps. But it's a bifurcation point then. So you have two steps, you get to AMP, and two other steps, you get to GMP, and then you're on your way to make RNA or DNA, and you have your purine nucleotide. So it's already made at the phosphorylated step right from the beginning. It has a ribose that's phosphorylated, so it's at the nucleotide level all the way. If you have a mutation in this pathway, and there are mutations in many of these now that have been selected, mainly using that BRDU technique, then the cell is not lethal to the cell because you can provide an alternative source of these nucleotide of these nucleotides of a particular kind. So if you add, for example, adenine, just the free base, there is a enzyme, adenine phosphoribosyl transferase, so that will add a ribose phosphate onto the adenine and you'll rebuild the nucleotide. So you start with the free base and you add ribose phosphate. Normally, this is not so important that because you have this de novo pathway that's at the nucleotide level all the way. Thus, this kind of pathway, this kind of enzyme is called a salvage enzyme or a salvage pathway enzyme. So you're salvaging adenine, which you might get from your diet, or you might get from the normal turnover of RNA in the cell. So you can reutilize these parts. You can also add adenosine, which is adenine plus ribose, and then there's an enzyme that will just phosphorylated adenosine kinase and also give you AMP. So that's a second salvage pathway. And if you have AMP, there's an enzyme that deaminates AMP and goes back to IMP, and then the IMP can take this lower fork and go to from hypoxanthine to xanthine and then to guanine. Also down here, mammalian cells have an enzyme that will take either hypoxanthine, and this is a phosphoribosyl transferase again, so exactly the same kind of reaction, but with different substrate specificity, to form IMP, which then can give you both AMP and GMP, or that same enzyme, sometimes called HGPRT for this reason, sometimes called HPRT because that's the preferred substrate, can give you GMP, but there's no back reaction for GMP. There's no enzyme that will do that. So if you're blocked over here, before IMP, then you can't make purines, giving guanine, even though it has this salvage pathway, will not satisfy the AMP requirement. Then there's other drugs. There's many drugs that are substrates for this salvage pathway enzyme that are used to good advantage this way. Very popular, maybe the most popular, 6-thioguanine. So that's got a sulfur instead of an oxygen at one point in the ring. And that's acted on by the HPRT. And so you'll form thioguanosine monophosphate, and that's lethal. So if you would knock out this salvage pathway, which normally you don't need, if you're wild type otherwise, then you get resistance to this drug. And because the HPRT gene is on the X chromosome in most mammals, then you only have to knock out one. So this is a very early target for mutagenesis studies and lots of studies that give you some of these numbers that I came up with of 10 to the minus 3 with mutagen, 10 to the minus 7 spontaneously. They're due to studies with HPRT gene. It's even used as a marker for exposure to mutagens by looking at blood cells and isolating how many blood cells out of millions are HPRT minus and therefore resistant to 6-thioguanine or 8-azoguanine. And the similar situation up here for adenine, you can kill cells with diaminopurine. If it gets ribophosphorylated, it's lethal. If you don't have it, it's no big deal, as long as you have the de novo pathway, which you normally do. But this is an autosomal enzyme. So here's where you have to use heavy mutagenesis. But even with heavy mutagenesis, you can isolate double knockouts for APRT. And then there are various other inhibitors. The folate, which we'll talk about as we go on, we'll keep talking about this DHFR, because it's important in the pharmaceutical industry. We have a very potent inhibitor of dietary reductase, methotrexate. It's also an anti-cancer agent, a cancer chemotherapy agent. And so if you inhibit DHFR, then you can't run this de novo pathway. So if you have amifampridine, which is a synonym for methotrexate, then you have to give the cells a source of purines like hypoxanthine, and a source of glycine, which is glycine, and a source of TMP, which is thymidine, I guess kinase. Right? So that's the de novo pathway. Colors aren't showing. Doesn't matter. So if you've absorbed everything I just said, which is impossible, but if you think about it and you look at that and you look at this pathway reproduced here, you could have various kinds of mutations and various kinds of media. And so I give you this slide as if you click here on the PowerPoint, you'll be taken to another form of this slide where you'll fill in these blanks every time you click. It'll give you the answer to this one, this one, this one, this one. Does it grow or doesn't it grow? So it might be a fun exercise. I'll give you a few here. Well, maybe I'll give you an example. Wild type, what's GHT? Here, G is glycine, H is hypoxanthine, T is thymidine. So the medium contains that, it says. Wild type certainly will grow in that. However, if you add methotrexate and you add glycine and thymidine but leave out hypoxanthine, then in the presence of methotrexate, you will be purine starved. Right? And you can't make purines anymore without tetrahydrofolate. And if you have methotrexate present, you can't do it. So they wouldn't grow there. On the other hand, if you take that same medium and I'll give them adenine, now the adenine can satisfy both purine requirements, even in the presence of methotrexate. So this is a famous medium that we'll talk about when we talk about monoclonal antibody cells. Another negative one. If, however, you're APRT minus, then, of course, the adenine is not going to do you any good, and you're still going to starve if you inhibit DHFR with methotrexate. So that's drug resistance. I won't spend as much time on these others. There's cell cycle mutants, which are so powerful in yeast, less studied in mammalian cells. One method is to, and this is kind of a general tool, is you add radioactive, especially tritiated, precursors to some pathway. Then if that pathway goes through and that radioactive precursor gets incorporated into a macromolecule, then that can kill the cell. If necessary, you could let them get incorporated and then freeze the cells and wait a month. And meanwhile, the radioactivity is decaying and it's breaking the molecules they're in. And tritium just goes a very short distance, a few microns inside the cell, so you can get very localized lesions. If it's in the DNA, then it's quite lethal. But even if it's in proteins, so the proteins, of course, like histones, are close to the DNA, that radioactive disintegration can cause mutations. So tritiated amino acids suicide was used, and for instance, if they can't put in radioactive leucine, then they found the amino acyl tRNA synthetase for leucine was knocked out, and there's several synthetases knocked out this way. Antibodies can be used to target specific cell surface proteins. You can lyse cells if you add complement, which is a series of proteases that are stimulated by antibody. And then you add an antibody against it so that surviving cells would be those that are no longer making the antigen, which is on the surface of the cell. This has been used against the major histocompatibility locus proteins especially. Rather than selection, you can do screening by visualization. This is much less powerful in terms of numbers, but it's still possible. So you could stain cells, for example, for for the presence of some enzyme. This is an X-linked enzyme, glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase. So you can get a good frequency of knockouts. And although the staining kills the cell, you can design your experiment so that you can gradually select for cultures that are showing a high number of stained, of non-staining colonies. Or you can actually do replica plating by taking a series of, trying to capture a portion of each colony of, say, several hundred colonies growing on a dish, and put them onto a membrane and then transfer it to another dish. This is tricky, but it's reported to work. Lactate dehydrogenase was isolated that way. So now you see, after you stain one dish, you see which colony was no longer staining blue, so it didn't, when you gave it lactose and all the other reagents to form a blue color for that enzyme, and then you go back to the same position on the still living unstained plate or dish and pick that colony. Or you can look for a secreted product by immunoprecipitating it. This has mainly been used for secretion of immunoglobulins themselves. So you have an antibody against an immunoglobulin. You can grow mouse myeloma cells, for example, that are producing antibody in suspended in agar. And then in the agar, you can incorporate an antibody against that antibody, say a goat anti-mouse antibody or rabbit anti-mouse. And you'll get an immunoprecipitate, essentially, surrounding the cells. So you can see all the cells, and they're almost all surrounded by an immunoprecipitate. But some cells, after mutagenesis, are even not. They don't have this ring of immunoprecipitate, so those are good candidates for no longer making the mutants that no longer make an immunoglobulin. Again, those kinds of mutants have been useful in the biotech industry. We talked about the fluorescence-activated cell sorter and how the cells are actually still viable after going through that cell sorter. And so you can take cells that are no longer producing a green color because of your green antibody against some cell surface or even against some internal protein. So, for instance, that fluorescent methotrexate that was used by Michnik, it's been used to isolate DHFR minus cells using the cell sorter. It's not so easy. And finally, there's some success just with brute force. If you're willing to screen individuals, subclones of a clone after that have survived heavy mutagenesis, and just look for evidence for a mutation. So, for example, you could grow up hundreds of cultures from individual survivors and screen them for the lack of some enzyme. Or you could electrophorese the extract from these and look for a change in electrophoretic mobility for mutants that still have enzymatic activity but have been altered. Sometimes these are handy markers to have. So that's less common. What's nice about these selections is that they're sort of intellectually challenging. If they work, it's very satisfying. Okay, so what about now the second tool of putting two alleles together in the same cell? So one early way to do this was cell fusion. This has turned out to still have some usefulness even today, although it went through a period before transfection where this was the only way sort of to to look at the combined effects of two alleles. So in cell fusion, you treat cells, you take two different kinds of cells, you mix them together and you co-cultivate them so they're all touching each other. Of course, you have cell A and cell B type. These could be from the same species, the same subclone. There could be just two variants or two mutants and you want to look at. Or they could be from a mouse cell versus a human cell, for example. And So if you add certain fusogenic agents, either certain viruses that sometimes if you get respiratory infection, you actually get fusion of the infected cells in your lungs. Syncytia form, great big cells with a bunch of nuclei, and that's that kind of inactivated virus of that type. But more easily, you can just use chemicals like polyethylene glycol. So then you just mix it in the cells, and they'll all start to fuse for some reason in their membranes. And then you get two kinds of fused cells. They're homokaryons, that is, two cell A's fused together. That's not very interesting. But you also have heterokaryons, where cell A and cell B have fused together. So there's one cytoplasm and two nuclei. Just after fusion, that's called a heterokaryon. So it's carrying two nuclei. And these are still being used to answer some questions. If you wait then, and that can take place at a very high frequency, like 10, 50%, 10%. If you wait, the cells will go through mitosis. Most of them are like out of sync and they will die. But some of them will be synchronized by chance and will form and then will go through mitosis, reform a nuclear membrane around all the chromosomes. So you start out with 46 chromosomes, you end up with 92 chromosomes. If it's two human cells, if it's Chinese hamster cells, you have 21 chromosomes, it becomes 42 chromosomes. And you have this hybrid cell. Sometimes there's a few chromosomes missing, often. These hybrid cells can grow. You can even do it again and get, these are now tetraploid cells, two diploid cells, let's say. You can even get octoploid cells, but after that it gets kind of clumsy. And the octoploids are not very healthy. But the tetraploids are pretty healthy, and you can keep them around. Especially if you have to do this, this is at a much lower frequency, one in 1,000 maybe at best. So you need some way to select those cells. So you apply, that's where all these markers that were produced in these purine and pyrimidine pathway enzymes come in handy. One cell's got an enzyme, is missing an enzyme for a particular pathway, the other parent is missing an enzyme for a different pathway. You put them together, and the only cells that can grow are the tetraploids that have in the same cell both pathways activated, one contributed by parent A, the other contributed by parent B. I think I have this picture here. So that's just a picture. So heterokaryons, one of the first uses, which I can show you, I think, well, here's like some of the markers that could be used. If this cell, for example, is HPRT-, then if you inhibit the purine biosynthetic pathway with methotrexate, or it used to be called amithopterin, and you give them a medium that's hypoxanthine, amithopterin, and thymidine, these won't grow because they can't salvage the hypoxanthine to get around the amithopterin block. On the other hand, another cell might be mutated in the thymidine kinase gene, so it can't salvage thymidine, which is also dependent on the DHFR and therefore is inhibited by this A, amithopterin. So this is also unable to grow, but for a different reason, because it can't make thymidylic acid. This one can't make purine nucleotides. But you put them together and you have these tetraploid cells are both thymidine kinase plus and HPRT plus. Right? And so they will be able to grow in this so-called HAT medium. So you can look at, put these two cells together and then look at some gene you're interested in and see whether it's dominant or recessive. So in the same cell. You can look at complementation analysis. That is, if you have two mutants with the same phenotype, but there may be many different genes that would give that phenotype, you can tell if they're in different genes or not, because if they're in different genes, they will complement each other. Whereas if they're in the same gene, then they're both missing the same function, they will not. And so you can start to organize and analyze cells that way. And then finally, since these cells aren't completely stable, they tend to lose chromosomes, and you can watch what chromosome is lost when you lose, let's say it's a human-mouse hybrid, and you lose a human chromosome, and you can tell where, what chromosome you measure the human protein, and you see it's gone when chromosome 6 is lost, but not when chromosome 7 is lost, so you know that it's on chromosome 6 without doing a multi-thousand-dollar sequencing of the whole genome. Let's look at some of the heterokaryon experiments. One of the earliest experiments that was very nice, this is Fry and Edidin's, a classical experiment. They took human cells and mouse cells and they fused them. And so you see the mouse cell surface proteins are circles, and the human ones are shown as squares here. And now you can add specific antibodies that are species specific, so they will identify the human or maybe a particular human cell surface protein. So right after fusion, you have these two nuclei, and you have all the human red ones up on one side of this tetraploid, on this heterokaryon, and all the green mouse cell surface proteins on the bottom. And now you, if you leave it at 0 degrees and look an hour later, it looks the same. But if you put them at 37 degrees, in 40 minutes, you see they're just all interspersed. And so that's a nice visualization and confirmation of the fluid mosaic model of the plasma membrane, of the cell membrane, where these proteins are free to diffuse all around the cell. And you could even measure at what temperature. You go down even below 20 degrees and you start to essentially freeze or solidify the cell membrane, so it's no longer fluid. Complementation analysis is you have two mutants that require glycine. You put them together. If they're both in the same enzyme in the glycine pathway, then they will not grow. But if they're in two different enzymes in the glycine pathway, then they will grow. So this is a sort of a classic complementation kind of analysis. It's done in genetics at all kinds of different genetic systems. That was hybrids. Here's a more recent experiment looking at RNA binding proteins. Most of them are nuclear. So the question here was, HNRPA1, which is a very abundant RNA binding protein in the nucleus that's thought to act by inhibiting splicing as one of its functions. And then HNRPC, which is another abundant RNA binding protein, they behave differently with respect to their cellular intracellular localization. So let's look at HNRPA1 first. These three panels are all of the same field under the microscope. So here's the view of the cell. This is a HeLa human cell and a frog cell. And they use the frog cell because they can easily differentiate it just by looking. The nucleus appears different. It's smaller, it has less nucleoli, which are these black dots, than the human nucleus. So they can tell that they have here a heterokaryon and not a homokaryon, and they can tell they have a fused cell as opposed to an unfused cell. So they focus on this particular fused cell. Of course, they did many, and they show results for this one. Here's an unfused cell. And now they stain it with an antibody against HNRPA1 after a day after fusion, let's say. So here are the two human nuclei. So this was actually three nuclei in this cell, two human nuclei and one frog nucleus. And the two human nuclei, notice, are labeled, light up with this antibody against A1, and you see in the cytoplasm there's nothing. So this is a nuclear protein. And yet, if you look over here, you see that this frog nucleus is also labeled. after a while. Whereas if you just look at a frog cell, there's no cross-reaction. You're getting no signal down here. So how they interpret this is that HNRMP1, although it's predominantly nuclear, has a lifetime in the cytoplasm, comes out into the cytoplasm, and then back into the nucleus, shuttling back and forth. And so since it can't tell the difference between the frog nucleus and the human nucleus, it gets into the frog nucleus. So this is now a standard assay for examining nuclear shuttling proteins. And in contrast, HNRMPC, in the same preparation, the same field, treated with a different color antibody, shows no evidence of shuttling from the human nucleus out into the cytoplasm and then into the frog nucleus. So the HNRPC is not a shuttling protein, whereas the HNRPA1 is a shuttling protein. Now you can argue, well, how do you know it's shuttling? Once you've combined these cells, there's actually messenger RNA for HNRPA1. It's made in the cytoplasm, so it's got to be at least in the cytoplasm right after it's made, before it gets into the nucleus. So once it's made in the cytoplasm, it just goes into the frog nucleus. It's none of this shuttling business. And once it's in there, it never gets out. So they did an important control experiment, which was to treat with, this is now in a different field, in a different cell, treat with cyclohexamide, which is a protein synthesis inhibitor. They add the cyclohexamide before they even do the fusion, and they get the same results. With C, you have these nuclei that are not lit up, but the frog nuclei in the heterokaryons, even if they're treated with protein synthetic inhibitor. So it's not new stuff that's getting in. It's old stuff that was made before the cyclohexamide was added, can get out of this nucleus and into that one. Okay, I won't have time to finish this, but let's start on it. So all of these cellular manipulations were somewhat limited because you're introducing a whole genome, and there was a period where you went through a lot of analysis, trying to figure out what's going on. You fused cancer cells with normal cells, what chromosomes are responsible, try to map the genes. It would have been so much easier if you could do as one does in E. coli, just transformation, add DNA from a single gene. Of course, this required recombinant DNA technology, and then after that required a way to efficiently get DNA, naked DNA, into these cells, into the nucleus, into the genome to be expressed. So that was completely analogous to the transformation of E. coli, this classic experiment that proved DNA was a genetic material. But the word transformation had already been used for the transformation from a normal cell, like these 3T3 cells, into a neoplastically converted cell, dysregulated cell. And that was called a neoplastic transformation. So we couldn't use the word transformation. So we used transfection. And that's because some of the very early experiments showing getting DNA or even RNA into the cells, like poliovirus RNA was put into cells, was like instead of infection, it was a viral DNA became a transfection. And that name stuck now, even though it doesn't apply simply to viral genes. So today we have lots of choices. It's still somewhat of a problem. You'll still see battles on the internet as my transfection reagent is better than your transfection reagent from the various companies, and with all the bar graphs to prove it. I'm just thinking. Since I only have 4 minutes, rather than start this list, which I'll start next time, I'll tell you a little bit more about the history. That early experiments, as I said, were done with viral DNA because it is simple. Other early experiments used total DNA from a cell and put it onto another cell and look for the transfer of some characteristic. And these were generally unsuccessful. Then, using some of these techniques that had some promise, which was the precipitation of the DNA with calcium ions. So you form a precipitate. If you add phosphate and calcium, it will precipitate. If you add calcium and phosphate and polyphosphate, which is like DNA, it will co-precipitate with the phosphate. And these pieces, which look terrible under the microscope, ugly, scraggly things you can actually see under the light microscope, some of that stuff gets taken up by endocytosis into the cells and gets incorporated. And to get those conditions right, a guy named Michael Wigler, who was a postdoc up at the medical school, decided to use herpes virus as a source of DNA. Because herpes virus, a big virus, has maybe, I don't know, 50 or 100 genes. But it's not like putting in 20,000 genes. So the herpes virus, we've already talked about, has that TK. And they had TK minus cells isolated, much as I indicated earlier, like the HPRT minus cells, there's thymidine kinase minus cells. So he took these mouse cells that were TK minus and took this simplified genome, but that had a gene for thymidine kinase. And he put them in this HAP medium so that only those that got the herpes virus thymidine kinase could grow. And when he did that, he got some small signal. He got some colonies, a few colonies, because his DNA was so enriched for this enzyme. Previous workers had just used total DNA from a TK plus cell. And that was the key. Once you have a little bit of a signal, this was kind of a very beautiful story, very logical. Once you have a little bit of a signal, that's all you need often, because then you can change the calcium exposure, change the calcium concentration, change the phosphate concentration, change the DNA concentration, keep optimizing until finally you have a very efficient process. I'm sort of surprised there hasn't been a Nobel Prize for that yet. But so that work was done in the laboratory of Richard Axel and Saul Silverstein uptown. So maybe on this. There they are, years ago. So Wigler's now at Cold Spring Harbor studying cancer. Axel's a neurobiologist uptown, Nobel Prize winner for something else. And Saul Silverstein is in the Department of Microbiology still uptown. So Axel was actually Wigler's mentor, and they collaborated with Silverstein, who had the the kind of a herpes virus expert. So so it was a very nice collaboration. And that method of getting DNA into mammalian cells and became very important manipulation for drug companies and accrued Columbia hundreds of millions of dollars over the 17-year life of that patent. Okay, so we'll get back to ways to transfect cells next time.